well as a human being can be ready for Daniel chapter 11. Maybe I'm ready. These are my Daniel 11 clothes. Not going home, not eating dinner, working on this, not getting a chance to change. I don't even have a belt on to hook my microphone, so I'm going with the pocket hook. So anyway, we'll see how this goes tonight. You guys are brave souls. Daniel 11 is where we're going to get into this evening. We're going to cover the first 35 verses tonight. And before we do that, let's definitely go to God in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we praise your name. You are so wise. You are so all-knowing. And it's amazing how you predicted all these things that we're going to study tonight, hundreds of years before they happened. We just marvel at your foreknowledge, that you are in control and that you are all-powerful. And we praise you for that. We pray that we'll use our study tonight to strengthen our faith, that we won't get so bogged down in the historical details that we miss the big picture, that you are the one true God and we are your servants. Help us grow as we study tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, so I gave you a couple handouts. I'll talk about those in a second. But as we come to Daniel 11, recall that Daniel has had four major visions, well, three major visions up to this point. But the latter half of Daniel is all about these four visions in chapter 7, 8, 9, and then 10, 11, and 12. And chapter 10 is really setting up the vision in 11 and 12. And remember that a couple of major themes from those visions is that you would have these worldly, earthly, Gentile powers, and they would come to power, and then when they interacted with God's people, there would be suffering of some kind. First, obviously, the Babylonians caused suffering by destroying Jerusalem, carrying the people off into captivity. But then the Persians would arise after them, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans. And so, like, chapter 7 talks about Rome, that fourth beast especially, wages war with God's people. Chapter 8 talks about Greece and this Antiochus, the fourth Epiphanes, who's going to wage war with God's people. We're going to talk about that tonight more as well. And then Daniel 9, the 70 weeks, is about Rome and how they, you know, the Messiah is killed in their era and the temple is desolated again in AD 70. So if you're Daniel, okay, I don't feel like the mic is on that much, but it's good. Okay, so if you're Daniel and you live through the temple's destruction in 586 BC, imagine how disturbing it would be to hear about all these disturbing and desolating things that are coming on the Jews in the future, all the suffering and the pain that they're going to endure. So we talked last class about Daniel 10, how he was praying for understanding. He wanted to know more detail about this future and what's going to happen to God's people. And he gets what he asks for. God gives him a lot of detail in chapter 11 about the coming future. Particularly as we talk through verses 1 through 35, we'll be talking about the Greek Empire after Alexander the Great. And then in verse 36, it's going to transition to talk about the Roman Empire, and we're going to get there on Sunday, Lord willing. So it is an incredibly detailed vision, and it can be confusing to keep track of. So I gave you all a printout. The colored printout is a list of the two major Grecian powers after Alexander the Great. And that's the Ptolemies of Egypt and the Seleucids of Syria. So the Ptolemies are down south and the Seleucids are up north. And you can kind of see on a map where they're located. There's the Ptolemies down in Egypt, and then the Syrian Empire is up there toward the north. And if you're wondering, why in the world should we even care about these two groups of people? Why do we have this big, long history lesson in Daniel? It's because look who's caught right in the middle of those two groups. The Jews. And these two groups of people, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, are going to be fighting for control of the land of Palestine where the Jews are. Because whoever controls Palestine gets to tax Palestine, gets to make money a lot of money off of the Jews, and it's from a war position, it's a strategic buffer between you and your enemy. Whoever controls Palestine has this nice buffer in between them and their enemies. So if you notice at the bottom of your color diagram here, just these basic points at the bottom, that during this period, there are six Syrian wars. And this is all stuff, by the way, you can look up on Google. You can find all of this historical information. It's all, nobody disagrees with anything that takes place in Daniel chapter 11. Even the most skeptic of scholars believe Daniel 11 is 100% accurate. But what they do is what? To explain it away, how do they deal with it? Yeah, they say, well, it must have been written later because there's no possible way it could be that accurate written hundreds of years before. But of course, their arguments for that are very weak and lame. And we look at that and it's an obvious display of the inspiration of God and the inspiration of His Word. And so during these six Syrian wars, the Jews are caught right in the middle. And while the Ptolemies rule, it's not too bad on the Jews. They have really high taxes, and that's kind of annoying, obviously. But other than that, it's not too bad. But once the Seleucids, and again, you can kind of see that on those four points, once the Seleucids take control of Palestine in 198 BC, that's when they're going to start pressuring the Jews to adopt Greek culture. And that's going to be a really difficult situation for the Jews morally to try to make sure that they're not compromising and denying God. And specifically, under the Seleucid rule, once Antiochus IV Epiphanes is in charge, he's going to make things really bad for the Jews. And he's going to start murdering Jews if they don't adopt Greek culture, if they don't worship these false gods. Okay, so it's going to be a really big problem. We're going to get pretty detailed into the history, but here's the main message that I want us to make sure that we get from this class. God was not silent about the 400 years of silence. It's true, there were no prophets during the 400-year period before John the Baptizer came, but it's not like God had not spoken about that time period. He knew exactly what was going to happen, and He tells the Jews through Daniel exactly what's going to happen so that when it happens, they won't be caught off guard and they won't be able to say that God has forgotten about them. When they see, hey, we're stuck in the middle of these two, you know, the Syrians up north and the Egyptians down south, we're stuck in the middle of these groups and things are not well, they're not going to be able to say, God, don't you know what's happening to us? Yes, He does know. Because He foretold exactly that that's what would happen in Daniel chapter 11. Also, when Antiochus Epiphanes comes in and wreaks havoc, they're not going to be able to say, God, how could you, you know, do you not know that this is happening? He knows. He says it's going to happen. And so think about this. This is why this is practical. Isn't it true we're living in years of silence right now? It's a lot longer than 400 years. It's about 1,900 years. 1,900 years of silence from the Lord. Yet was God silent about our age? Well, no. He wasn't as detailed as He was in Daniel 11. You know, He doesn't lay out all the kingdoms and the presidents and, you know, all the countries and all that that would take place in the 1,900 years. But He gives us His Word, which still speaks truths to us today about our modern day. So I just want to ask you all, what are some general things that the New Testament said would happen in the future that absolutely have happened and still continue to happen today? How does God speak about these 1,900 years of silence that we've been in? Brenda?
The first thing I thought you said that was the falling
away. Okay. Yeah, that people would fall away from the faith and they would listen to false doctrines. Absolutely. The Bible predicted that. That happens today. That's already happened. It continues to happen today. Herb?
That people will call lies a truth and truth a lie.
Yeah.
And it sure is happening what today.
Absolutely.
Romans chapter 1, people will exchange the truth of God for a lie, and professing to be wise, they will become fools. Absolutely. All the time. Absolutely. Terry?
The famines, earthquakes, wars.
Yes.
Wars, famines, earthquakes. Absolutely. That's all been going on. Definitely. I think about Romans 1, the man will exchange the natural use of the man or of the woman and burn in their desire for each other. Talking about homosexuality there, and vice versa with the women. That happening all the time today. Jason?
Kind of in line with calling the truth a lie and a lie the truth. We rename things. Years ago, I did a imitation talking about this. We put the word adult in front of something, like it's going to make it, you know, that's an adult beverage. What does that mean? That means it's something you can sin badly on by getting drunk. Oh, this movie has adult situations. What does that mean? That means there's going to be sin, sexual sin, on display. And trying to rename something to pretend it is no longer a sin is a big part of this more subtle way to claim the truth is a lie and the lie is the truth.
Yep, that's a good point. Really good point. Yeah, what about us suffering calamity for our faith? What about us being persecuted for our faith? Didn't Jesus say the world will hate you? And if they persecuted the master, of course they're going to persecute the servants. So when that happens, should we say, God, how could you, you know, did you not know that this would happen? Well, no, of course he did. He said it would happen. Sure. Steve?
Earthquakes.
Okay, yeah. Earthquakes, sure. Natural disasters. Yeah. Brandy?
False teachers. Wolves in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, false teachers. People will creep into the church. Wolves in sheep clothing. Absolutely. Kurt?
That men will worship the creature rather than the creator.
Yeah, absolutely. Worship the creature rather than the creator. Terry?
Thessalonians, it talks about the man of lawlessness. Don't really know what that is.
Take me there, Terry.
Be careful.
I'm already, you know how much energy I've taken for Daniel 11? Don't bring the man of lawlessness into this tonight's class, too. I need another week for that. So, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, we'll go with that, Jerry.
I think that might be the potentially the Roman emperor that destroys the temple, possibly. I don't know, though. Brenda.
Just saying that bad things are good and good
things are bad. Okay, yeah. Good things are bad. Bad things are good. Yeah. Even back in the Old Testament, I mean, Isaiah 5:20, it says you call good evil and evil good. You switch. You switch the sweet for bitter and the bitter for sweet. We do the same thing. Yeah, so God's word is timelessly true. Oh, yeah, sure. You have one more?
I was going to say how the natural man doesn't understand the things of the Spirit, and it's just so obvious today.
Yeah.
And no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. The natural man doesn't understand the spiritual things. And yeah, the more we go toward the natural, and even denying the supernatural, the more foolish we become and the less able to see God's will. Yeah?
Well,
that
they no longer worship in Jerusalem. They worship the truth of the Spirit.
Yeah, great. So the way that we worship has changed, and God has spoken about that too. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, God's word is just timelessly applicable. And just because God is silent today in the sense that he doesn't have prophets still verbally speaking to us doesn't mean he hasn't already spoken about the silence. And that gives me great comfort because I know God is in control. I know no matter what happens in his life, God already knew it. It is not like God is surprised by anything at all. And I know that just like there was hope for God's people in Daniel's day, if they would stay faithful to him, so too if we stay faithful. There's always hope for us. God will deliver us. Okay, so that was kind of the softball opening, you know, so that we could warm you up a little bit and get Daniel 11 cranking here. So let me just say this. I gave you all also an outline, a very detailed outline, front and back. I would not advise reading along in your outlines with me as I go through this, because that may be a little too confusing. It's probably better to watch the PowerPoint, because I'm going to try to make this visual so you can kind of see the history playing out in a visual way, though it's not super fancy visuals. However, I do go into much more detail in that outline, and I'm going to have to skip some things, you know, as we go through it just for time's sake. But definitely take advantage of that outline. It'll take you straight through verse by verse exactly how each verse plays out in history in detail with all the names and the dates and the battles and all of that stuff. Jeff?
I just had a question on the color chart.
Okay.
You talked about
the control was one of the ABC, and they were personal Jews to adopt the Greek culture. Is that where Hellenistic Jews come to be, just through that?
Sure, yeah, that's where it would have started. Yeah, with Antiochus III the Great there in 198. He's the one that starts to pressure the Jews into adopting Greek culture. And yes, they do start to kind of adopt Hellenism. Some of the Jews do. And yeah, the Hellenistic Jews would have kind of had their origin there. And then Antiochus, of course, you know, he really tries to enforce that with violence even. Yeah, and that's why I put Antiochus in red there, because he's the guy that... honestly, all this history is leading up to. I think that's really the main point, is to kind of show the origin of how Antiochus Epiphanes came about, because he's the one that really is going to cause so much trouble for the Jews. Okay, so Daniel chapter 11, this angelic being is still talking from chapter 10. He's continuing this conversation, and he just says, "To Daniel, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him." Talking about Michael the archangel. He's saying, I, as an angelic being, helped Michael the archangel on some occasion. And now, verse 2, "I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia, and then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." So the fourth Persian king is Xerxes. And does anyone remember where we read about Xerxes? His other name is Ahasuerus.
Esther.
Hey, Esther. Now there's some, we're not 100% sure on the chronology with Esther. Some believe that that huge banquet he threw for like 180 days was kind of like a preparation for him getting ready to go and attack and plunder Greece. He was very rich. I mean, that's obvious from reading Esther, that he's very, very wealthy. And so he goes and he attacks Greece. Now, he does pretty severe damage to the Greeks, but the Greeks end up winning, and Xerxes is forced to return home in defeat. And I think the reason Daniel 11:2 points him out is because he's the one that kind of poked the hornet's nest, and he made Greece really, really angry with the danger that he did. And so he, you know, he poked the bear, he awoke the beast, and the beast is in verse 3, "A mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases." This is going to be Alexander the Great, and he goes on this incredible just conquering spree, and he conquers all this entire Syrian empire and names a bunch of cities, like 5, you know, maybe 10 cities, Alexandria, and after himself, obviously. And he's so powerful, but if you remember when we talked about Daniel 8, he actually dies early. He's the horn on the unigoat, remember? And it says that when the horn rises to power, he breaks off and four horns shoot up in his place. That's what verse 4 is talking about. So as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside them. So he dies prematurely, like around age 33, and his kingdom is then divided, not among his children, but among four generals: Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And again, this is the same point back in chapter 8 about the goat's horn, or having four horns. It's these four generals that rise up in his place. And once again, though, you can see on the colored chart that I gave you that it's the Ptolemies and the Seleucids that are going to be the main players. These other two generals, they don't really have that much power. They kind of fade off of the scene. And these two, Seleucus and Ptolemy, are the main powers. Now, all throughout Daniel, something like 15 times, Daniel 11, 15, I didn't count them all, maybe 17, you're going to find the phrases, king of the south and king of the north. The king of the south is whichever king is descended from Ptolemy in the south. The king of the north is whichever king descends from Seleucus in the north. Now, the way I remember this, like which is which, is that Ptolemy, even though it's not pronounced this way, but Ptolemy starts with a P, and so does Pharaoh. And so for me, I just, as soon as I hear Ptolemy, and then I have to immediately remind myself, oh, Ptolemy starts with a P. Oh, like Pharaoh, Egypt, down south. To me, that helps. Another way, and this may not help you at all, but if I can give you a couple different options, maybe it'll help, is that you have the Seleucids of Syria in the north. Now, you would think that it, because it all starts with an S, it would be really nice to be Seleucids of Syria in the south. But it's not. It's the opposite of what you think. It's the Seleucids of Syria, and you want to say south, but don't, because it's the opposite. They're in the north. Okay, so there's another way to maybe remember it. And interestingly, the capital city, I meant to put a marker on this, I might have it covered up, actually. Anyway, the capital city, I think, is right here, of Syria. Does anybody know the name of the capital city at that time? Antioch. Okay, Antioch. And interestingly, that's where they will first be called Christians in the New Testament, in Antioch. And when we read about Paul, you know, he travels to Antioch of Syria in Acts chapter 13 and gives the sermon. And it also says that on his journey, he goes down, and I don't think this city is on this map, but anyway, he goes down to Seleucia, the city of Seleucia, which you can see is all rooted in this Seleucid empire.
Good question.
Yes, sir.
Ruling Syria are not even from Syria. They're from a Greek king named Seleucus and his offspring. Not king, Greek general, sorry.
Yes, that's true.
Weird.
Yeah, I mean, I guess geographically, yeah, they were. Yeah, because they were scattered throughout the empire after
Alexander. It's not an Egyptian, but another Greek general.
True.
And they're ruling. That's
weird. Yeah, they're just right. Because we're thinking, oh, they should be Egyptians if they're ruling in Egypt, or they should be Syrians if they're. Yeah, they're Greeks.
I mean, they're Marian Syrian wives or Egyptian wives.
Yeah, they're probably sure adopted some of that culture. But yeah, these are Grecian powers over these places.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I thought there was another thing I wanted to point out about that. That I didn't have in my notes. Okay, maybe not. Yeah, I know there was something that's on the tip of my tongue, but I forgot what it was. Okay, so let's move on then to verse 5, because now we get into these first rulers, okay, and these dynasties are the first ones on your colored chart that you have, and that's Seleucus, the first Nicator, and Ptolemy the first Soter. And verse 5, the king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His domain will be a great dominion indeed. So Ptolemy Soter actually helps Seleucus avoid destruction because another one of Alexander's generals comes and tries to attack Seleucus and take Syria from him. And so Ptolemy actually helps Seleucus. He protects Seleucus. And then the Ptolemies really gain power. He's the one that's going to gain ascendancy and dominion. And I went ahead and enlarged that box to engulf Palestine as well, because he's going to then control Palestine. And actually, these Ptolemies, they're going to have control of Palestine for like 100 years. So they're going to be great in power. Now, after those two kings have died, we have another two kings. We have Antiochus the second. Well, that's what I was going to say. I knew it was coming up. Because Antioch was the capital of Syria, many of the kings will be called Antiochus. Okay, so that was what I wanted to say. Antiochus and the Seleucus. Those are kind of the two main names in that Seleucid dynasty. So now you have these two kings. And as a sign of peace, Ptolemy the second gives Antiochus the second his daughter, Berenice. as an alliance. But here's the problem. Antiochus already had a wife. Her name was Laodice. And they had a son together named Seleucus Callinicus. So if you're looking for the next name of your child, you go with Callinicus. And that's a problem. But apparently a part of the deal of taking Berenice as his wife, he had to get rid of and send Laodice away. Now pause. Does Laodice sound familiar to you? Yeah, Laodicea. Okay. Antiochus II actually had power over Asia Minor, and he named the city Laodicea after his wife, Laodice.
Is that where she went?
Yeah, actually, he sends her over to Asia Minor, and along with her child, and he is now married to Berenice. Well, after Ptolemy II dies, then Antiochus tries to get back with Laodice. Apparently, he wasn't really all that into Berenice. It was in his best interest politically. And so once he kind of lost that political tie with Ptolemy II, once he died, well, then he doesn't really have much interest that much in Berenice, and he wants Laodice back. Well, Laodice didn't take what happened earlier very well, and she murders him. She poisons him. He dies.
She had somebody
do it. I don't know. I don't know if it was... Oh, is that what... What's that? Well, Oliver said she had somebody poison him? Okay, yeah. So I didn't know if it was her directly or if she sent somebody. Guess who else she murders?
Berenice.
And guess who else she murders? Okay, yeah. The son that Antiochus and Berenice had, which I don't really have that on the screen, just... I didn't want to confuse you with even more names. But so now it's just Laodice and now her son, Seleucus Callinicus, and she puts him on the throne. So now it's Seleucus II, Callinicus, and his mother, Laodice, who are kind of in charge up in Syria. Well, there's a giant problem because Berenice had a brother, Ptolemy III, Euergetes. And he wasn't too happy that Laodice just murdered his sister. And so he comes up and he attacks Syria. He murders Laodice. I almost want to say Laodicea. He murders Laodice and fights against Syria. And Seleucus Callinicus doesn't really do much. In fact, unexpectedly, he dies when he falls off his horse. Well, then, Seleucus III, Soranus, is going to reign for a few years, and then he is assassinated. And then we come to Antiochus III the Great, who comes to power. This is where the power really shifts from the Ptolemies to the Seleucids. Starting in 198 BC, the Seleucids will have control of Palestine. And verse 11 through 16 is going to show how all of that happens. Okay, so if you look in Daniel 11, verse 10, it says his sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow. This is Antiochus III, the Great, he's talking about. Overflow and pass through that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. So he's going to have tremendous success, Antiochus the Great will. And again, before Antiochus the Great, the Jews just had to pay taxes, and that was annoying. But now that he's in control, now they're kind of going to be pressured. And not necessarily pressured in terms of we're going to kill you, but just he wants to unify the nations under the Hellenistic culture. And so there was automatically a pressure of, hey, we got to get in line here. If you want to kind of be on the good side of Antiochus the Great, like we should probably do what he says and adopt the Greek culture. And so you're already having some of this tension arise in the Jews with these issues. Well, we need to skip ahead a little bit to verses 18 and 19. And again, hopefully you've noticed on the screen, I've got the verses on the bottom right there that this period is talking about. So we have Antiochus III the Great, and what he does is he sets his sights now that he's really powerful, he sets his sights on the Greek islands. But Rome isn't having any of that. And they send their generals, Scipio Asiaticus and Scipio Africanus, and they squash his efforts at trying to take that territory. And he is forced to return home in defeat. And he's forced to surrender territory. And then, because of what he did, Rome actually exacts horrendously high taxes on Syria. And Rome takes 20 hostages, one of which is a man named Mithridates. Now remember him, because he's coming back up in a second. But Antiochus the Great, he comes back, and he's actually murdered by an angry mob. Now, in verse 20, his son, Seleucus the Fourth Philopater, sends a man named Heliodorus down to collect taxes from Palestine. Because think about it, Rome just put a ton of taxes on Syria, so they need to make money. So what Seleucus does is he says, I need to send a man down to take money from the Jews so that we can have enough money to pay Rome. Well, Heliodorus does that. He goes down, he cleans out the temple treasury, and then he comes back to Seleucus and actually murders Seleucus and takes the throne. Well, remember, Seleucus the Fourth had a brother named Mithridates who was taken to Rome as a hostage. Well, Mithridates was actually let loose from Rome on a hostage exchange. There was actually a trade made, and Mithridates was set free. Well, when he becomes free, he kicks... I'm surprised he didn't murder Heliodorus. I don't think he murders him, but he does kick him off the throne. He takes the throne for himself, and Mithridates changes his name to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. That is our horrendous character that Daniel has been leading up to, one of the worst persecutors of the Jews in history.
So he's got a lot of anger from this.
Oh, yeah.
Angry man.
He is a very angry man and a very small man who gets very offended very easily. And verses 20 through 24 just talk about how he was such a schemer. He was a deceiver and a liar. He would regularly make alliances with nations, and he would back out on his word. We have to skip ahead again. But in verses 27 and 28, after Antiochus Epiphanes actually had a victory over Egypt, later the Egyptians say, look, we want to be friends with you, Antiochus. And so Antiochus comes, and you know, they're acting like they're friends and everything is great, but Antiochus gets a taste of his own medicine. The Egyptians go back on their agreement with him. Antiochus is furious, and he returns back home. But on his way back home in fury, he stomps on the Jews and takes his angry frustration out on them by plundering treasure from the temple and even murdering Jews. And we read about this actually in the book of 1 Maccabees. It's not inspired, but it contains history from the period written by the Jews. I'm going to have to read this way because it's cut off on the TV. Something. After Antiochus had defeated Egypt in the 143rd year, he returned and went up against Israel and against Jerusalem with a strong force. He insolently entered the sanctuary, took away the golden altar, the lampstand for the light with all its utensils, the offering table, cups and bowls, golden censers, the curtain. I'm not sure what cornices mean. And the golden... Oh. Whoops. What did you say? The cornice? Oh, they cover window. Okay, very good. That's the first time I really noticed that word. He stripped all that off. He took away the silver and gold and the precious vessels. He took all the hidden treasures he could find. Taking all this, he went back to his own country. He shed much blood and spoke with great arrogance. And there was great mourning throughout all Israel. The rulers and the elders groaned. Young women and men languished, and the beauty of the women faded. The bridegroom took up lamentation, while the bride sitting in her chamber mourned, and the land quaked on account of its inhabitants, and all the house of Jacob was clothed with shame. And by the way, this isn't even the main persecution yet. This is just the first time he comes through. And it's going to get worse. Because a couple years later, still fuming over the Egyptians for going back on their word, Antiochus says, I'm going to come back, and I'm actually going to take over Egypt. Well, Antiochus gets right to the brink of Egypt, and Rome finds out about it. And they send an ambassador named Popilius down here with a note from the Roman Senate saying, you mess with Egypt, you mess with us. And Antiochus says, well, I guess I need to go, you know, I need to maybe think about this and consult with my counselors and see what they tell me to do. And famously, Popilius, he takes a big stick and he draws a circle around Antiochus while he's standing there, and he says, you can think about it as long as you want, as long as you're in this circle. He said, but the second you step out of this circle, you better have made up your mind. So he says, I'm out of here. He says, I'm not messing with Rome. And of course, because he's a small man, an arrogant man, his pride is just crushed. He's furious. And now this is when he comes back to Jerusalem and really stomps on them. He's absolutely furious, even worse than before. And in 167 BC, he comes in, desecrates the temple. He sets up an altar to Zeus. He forbids the Jews to make any sacrifices to Yahweh. He offers a pig on the altar, which is an unclean animal, splatters the blood on the temple walls. He allows fornication with temple prostitutes in the temple. He threatens to murder Jews if they don't break covenant with God. He even murders women and children, and he murders many faithful people who try to stand up for what's true. And interestingly, in verse 35, it says that this is a time of refinement and purging to make them pure until the end of time. It seems the point there is that this is a time to test who's really faithful to Yahweh or not. Who will stand up against this evil influence in the land? And really, this is a challenge for all of us, right? That in America, we're living in a time of unprecedented ease for Christians. People in other parts of the world are being persecuted right now. And probably, if history is any factor in this, in the future, we'll probably be persecuted again. And we need to make sure that we are shoring up our faith now so that we can stand faithful when something crazy like this happens. And of course, it's a little bit different now under the new law of Christ, but they handled it differently back then, because when we go back to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, one of his soldiers was forcing the Jews to offer a sacrifice to Zeus on threat of death. And there was a man, a priest named Mattathias, and he refused to do it. Well, a big crowd had gathered around. And a Jew from the crowd said, I'll do it. I'll offer the sacrifice to Zeus. I imagine he was trying to protect Mattathias. Mattathias murders that Jew for offering that wicked sacrifice. And then he murders the Syrian soldier that was making them do it. And then he and his sons flee to the mountains. And one of his sons was named Judas, who was later given the nickname Maccabee, which means the hammer. And he became the Jewish general who led for the next 3 years the Jews to revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, victory after victory against all odds, so that just 3 years later, in 164 BC, the Jews actually reclaimed the temple, cleansed it, and now they're worshiping again. And they celebrate that that day when the temple was then restored. They celebrate it even to this day. It's called Hanukkah, or as John 10, verse 22 calls it, the Feast of Dedication. Because they actually gain liberation there from Antiochus Epiphanes. And I just want to make this last point that this time in their history also shows why, when you come to the New Testament, they took Sabbath keeping so seriously. Because in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, that was one of the marks of your faithfulness. Because you could be murdered for keeping the Sabbath. But only the most faithful Jews kept that Sabbath day. And they weren't going to, same with circumcision. You know, we're going to keep circumcising our babies. We're not going to listen to you, Antiochus. And so when you come to the New Testament, they're so serious about that. And it also shows why they hate the Gentiles so much, because look at all this horrible stuff that has been perpetrated on them by the Gentiles. So God was not silent about the 400 years of silence, and God is not silent about these years of silence today either. And if we'll stay faithful to God, He will deliver us. That's Daniel 11, and there's only 7 seconds left, and I'm sorry. If you want more detail, that outline is going to give you a lot more detail. But thank you all so much for your kind attention. If you have questions, feel free to ask. And Lord willing, we'll cover Daniel 11:36 through the end of Daniel on Sunday.